This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Last year, American journalists Laura Ling and Yuna Lee were working on a documentary on the border between China and North Korea when they were taken prisoner by North Korean soldiers. They were held for 5 months at a time when North Korea's nuclear program was heightening tensions with the United States. While Laura Ling was being held, her sister Lisa was in the United States working frantically to secure her release. The two sisters have a new book which details Laura's brutal capture, as well as her interrogation and trial in North Korea, and Lisa's quick immersion into the world of diplomacy with one of the most politically isolated countries on Earth. I spoke to them recently about their book called Somewhere Inside, One Sister's Captivity in North Korea and the Other's Fight to Bring Her Home. Laura Ling, Lisa Ling, welcome to Fresh Air. Laura, let me start with you. Describe the story that you were looking for when you traveled to the Chinese-Korean border.
Well, Dave, we were covering a story about North Korean defectors, people who are fleeing the very desperate conditions in North Korea, mass starvation, a brutal dictatorship, and they are crossing over into China. Now, many of these defectors are women, and many of these women are trafficked into really horrendous situations in neighboring China. They are forced into marriages. They are lured into the prostitution industry. And because China does not regard North Korean defectors as refugees, they will send them back across the border to North Korea if they are caught. And that means that these people face certain punishment. They will be sent to North Korea's notorious labor camps and possibly face torture or worse. That's the story that I was trying to bring to light for Current TV.
Now you were there with Yuna Lee, an editor and producer with you, and Mitchell Koss, a producer and cameraman, right?
That's right.
Now, did the Chinese know you were there as journalists?
They didn't. We were traveling as tourists. As I said, this is a story that the Chinese government, it's a sensitive story. And, you know, oftentimes the decision is made to either travel officially as journalists or as tourists. And traveling officially in China means that you are approved by the government and you have a media entity with you at all times. And it's a story that we felt could be best told as tourists, as well as to protect the people that we were interviewing as well.
You know, one of the most interesting parts of the story comes in the opening pages, and that involves the guide who was with you to take you to this border region. And his behavior in getting you to the border and his conduct at the border seemed pretty peculiar. Tell us what happened.
Well, this is a guide that we had hired, a fixer, and foreign journalists who are working overseas often hire what we call fixers, local guides in the area who have worked with other media entities before to help them with the story. And this was a man who we had hired who had previously seemed very cautious. And there were some actions that in retrospect were suspicious. While we were on the ice, we were filming. We went to the river to film the thoroughfare where North Koreans are crossing into China. It was never our intention when we were there that morning to cross the river.
This is the Tumen River that separates Korea and China, right?
That's correct. Right. And you know, our guide began making some low hooting noises across the border. Now, previously, our guide had told us that he had connections in North Korea. Our guide was involved in smuggling goods himself. And so in my mind, I thought he was trying to make connection with some of the border guards that he knew. He said that in the past he had taken some media to actually converse with some of these border guards on the other side. And he continued to walk closer to the North Korean side of the river. And he got to the other side, stepped foot on the soil, and motioned for us to follow him, which we did. We ended up on the other side of the border, and he pointed out a village off in the distance where he said there were some safe houses where defectors are kept until they're ready to be smuggled across the border. And really, it was about that time we were not on the soil for more than a minute before we knew we had to leave. And that's when we turned back and walked back across the ice to the Chinese side.
So you, when you approached the Chinese-Korean border here at the Tumen River, you had no plan to actually cross into North Korea?
Absolutely not.
In any case, you and two other journalists now, having planned to approach the North Korean border, find that you have crossed this frozen river, set foot on North Korean soil for a minute or so, and then start back. But then trouble comes when you encounter North Korean guards. What happened?
I heard soldiers yelling from behind me. I turned around, and there were two North Korean soldiers running across the ice toward us with their rifles in their hands pointed in the air. And I just ran for my life. I ran as fast as I could. I reached the Chinese side, and literally I could not feel my feet being able to run anymore after being on the Chinese soil for a few moments, and I fell to the ground. Yuna, who was behind me, as she was approaching me, she stopped to help me, and within seconds, the two North Korean soldiers were above us with their rifles pointed at us. They then were determined to get us back across the ice to North Korea. The one above me was particularly fierce. He kicked me in the head and the shoulder a number of times while I was on the Chinese soil and then again on the ice. And then at one point he raised his rifle and I saw the butt of his rifle headed for me. I thought that that could be the end of my life. And he then proceeded to strike my head with the butt of the rifle. And that's when I blacked out on the ice.
So, Laura Ling, you were, after this encounter with North Korean guards at the border, were taken to North Korea. What kind of places were you taken to initially?
Along the border, we were taken to several army posts. These were very rudimentary areas, just kind of dirt clearings. And inside these army posts, there were a series of bunk beds with, you know, very thin stained mattresses, no electricity whatsoever. I couldn't spot any real signs of technology in the first few locations where we were taken. Eventually, we were brought to a jail and placed in a cell separately. The cell was about 5 by 6 feet, metal door with no, if they, there were a couple slats on the doors where a guard could peer in and shine his flashlight. But when those slats were closed, it was completely pitch black. Concrete floor, a wooden pallet with a couple of blankets to sleep on. Very, very dismal conditions.
Right. Now to clarify, there were three of you that approached the border. Mitch Koss, the producer and cameraman, managed to get away, get back to China. But you and your editor and producer, Yuna Lee, were captured. She was fluent in Korean, so you were able, the two of you, I guess, to communicate. What did you tell your captors?
Well, when we were initially caught, Yuna had told our captors that we were students. We were working on a documentary, that we were film students. And we were working on a piece about the border region and trade in the region. We knew that the subject we were covering, North Koreans fleeing these horrible conditions in their country, was not going to be looked upon well by our captors. And so we were hoping that while we were still on the border, we might be able to convince them to send us back across the border to China. And that became very clear after about 24 hours that that was not going to happen and that we would have to tell them that we were journalists.
And you had materials on you which could have put some of your people, some of your sources in jeopardy, right?
Well, the materials that we had on us, we were very careful when we filmed in China because we know that this was a very sensitive story. So I had pictures on a still camera, for example, that had the backs of the heads of some of the interviewees who we spoke with in China But even so, I didn't want to take that risk of them seeing this material. So for a brief moment, we were left with our belongings. I proceeded to delete some of these pictures. Yuna, on one of her videotapes, had an interview that I had conducted with a defector. Again, it only showed the bottom half of his body, and the locations in which we shot them were far from where these people actually lived. But we didn't want to take any chances. And so we proceeded to destroy this evidence, as well as eating some of the notes that I had in a small notebook.
You ate notes?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, because one of the three of you who were on this project managed to get back to China, they were able to get word to your families that you had been captured in North Korea, which takes us to your end of the story, Lisa Ling. When you heard that Laura had been detained in North Korea, who did you call?
Well, I got a call at 2:30 in the morning on March 17th from my brother-in-law, Laura's husband, Ian. And the first thing he said was, Laura has been abducted by North Korean border guards. And that just sent a complete shock through my system because Laura, there was never any intention to go anywhere near North Korea. Their assignment was to go to China and to South Korea. So we were shocked. I knew that the story that they were covering, but I didn't think that they were going to really get close to North Korea. So Ian and I immediately, I had Ian call our parents because we needed our mother to make contact with Chinese authorities in China, and she's proficient in Mandarin. And I just started calling everyone in the diplomatic world that I knew. One of my first calls was to Richard Holbrooke, who is the U.S. Special Representative to Afghanistan and the most senior diplomat I know. And I wanted to get word to Secretary of State Clinton that this was happening. And one of the first calls that we also made was to the chairman of Current TV, Laura's employer, Vice President Al Gore, because we felt like if this was going to become the international incident that we thought it could, we needed Vice President Gore to help us.
Right now, because you're both journalists who've worked in national and international stories, you had contacts in the government and in the media. And, of course, Laura's employer, as you said, was Current TV, who's one of its top executives, was Vice President Gore. So one of the interesting parts of the story on your end, I thought, Lisa, was that you talked to Vice President Gore, who was enormously helpful, gave you contact information, said that he would do what he could. You also had heard that New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson had been on similar humanitarian missions in North Korea, managed to reach out to him. He also contacted you, but they had very different takes on how to approach this. What did they tell you?
Well, from the get-go, Vice President Gore and members from the State Department who had been advising us had strongly suggested that we keep things very, very quiet. And that was very understandable because we didn't know exactly what happened to Laura and Yuna. So we were also fearing that the North Koreans might do something drastic. I mean, this is a highly, highly unpredictable regime. The story that Laura and Yuna were covering was a very, very sensitive one. So before knowing anything, we just thought we should maintain silence. But I just started to reach out to as many contacts as I could. And one of the people who is most closely associated with U.S.-North Korea relations is Governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson. He, of all American, of any American, has had the most successes in negotiating the releases of previous American detainees in North Korea. So he was a natural sort of connection to make. And he was incredibly helpful from the start and told me that he would start making contacts with the State Department and his contacts in North Korea. And a couple of days into our conversations, he was actually approached by President Obama and Secretary Clinton and asked to actually help on our behalf.
Well, it struck me as interesting that they had very different views about whether it would be helpful to get the Chinese government involved.
Yes. Vice President Gore wanted to try and get the Chinese government to help us with this situation because China has been considered North Korea's biggest ally. Governor Richardson, on the other hand, who had dealt with North Korea for many, many years, was vehemently against involving China because he said that the North Koreans loathe having to deal with the six-party talks and having to use China as a go-between in communication with the United States. And what the North Koreans have been wanting for many years is to have a direct line to the United States. The U.S. and North Korea have no diplomatic relationships, so they only communicate through a third-party country in Sweden or through the six-party talks or from a humanitarian mission that they have in New York. But other than that, communication is next to zero. And according to Governor Richardson, the North Koreans have been trying to ignite a kind of direct relationship with the United States, and they'd be insulted if China were asked to get involved.
Meanwhile, Laura Ling, you were in Korea and were in these border regions with very, very Spartan conditions. I mean, you said there's virtually no signs of technology at all. But eventually it becomes apparent to your captors that they have an American journalist here, that this is important, and they send you to the capital, Pyongyang. Tell us about that journey and how it changed the way you were treated.
Well, Dave, once we were transferred to Pyongyang, Yuna and I were separated. So from that moment on, I was by myself, and I was placed in a compound in Pyongyang. The conditions were basic, but they were improved from that jail along the border. I was in a bedroom with a real bed, an adjoining bathroom, and an area where there were two guards at all times who could look in on me. Of course, this is North Korea, and there were frequent power outages and water outages, but my treatment did change, and I was treated fairly. One of the things that was quite damaging to my situation in the beginning was the fact that my sister had been to North Korea before and had worked on a documentary for National Geographic Television that was quite critical of the North Korean regime. So on top of everything, here I was confronted with these very irate North Korean authorities who knew about Lisa's work in North Korea, which only compounded the situation.
Right, and you were hoping that they might not make that connection. It seems that they did pretty quickly.
They asked for my family history, and I had to decide what to write. They asked for all of my immediate relatives' names and professions. But I knew that in Pyongyang they had access to technology and the internet, and a simple internet search would reveal Lisa's profession. So I wrote her name, and I said that she was a correspondent, but I didn't write for whom. I didn't say that she worked for the Oprah Winfrey Show or had done work for National Geographic, CNN, and elsewhere.
And Dave, that was something that was so the complexities involved were so surreal and just wild. I mean, when I first heard that Laura was being held captive in North Korea, one of my first fears was that they would associate her with me, because the documentary that I worked on for National Geographic was incredibly critical. And during Laura and Yuna's captivity, we had a brand new president in Barack Obama, brand new Secretary of State, high-profile Secretary of State in Hillary Clinton. The tensions on the Korean Peninsula had been worsening and becoming increasingly more severe. And some say that it was one of the low points in U.S.-North Korea relations. So all of these things were happening while my sister was somewhere inside the most secretive country on earth.
And of course, Laura initially told her captors the lie, that she was a college student working on a piece about trade between along the border of China and Korea, eventually has to own up to being a journalist. And now they discover that, in fact, she's part of a family that did a story in an international broadcast outlet that was very critical of the regime. It's a real jam to be in, wasn't it, Laura?
Well, the phrasing that my interrogator used, or the question he posed to me, was, "Are you and your sister trying to bring down the North Korean government?" And I was faced with having to answer that question.
So, Laura, then there was a period of many, many weeks where you were held in this holding facility in Pyongyang, the capital, and had daily interrogations by this gentleman that you call Mr. Yi. Long and intense interrogations. What did they want you to say?
Well, they interrogated me about everything. They wanted to know about my work history, all of the past assignments that I've done, the current piece that I was working on for Current TV. But I knew what they were really getting at, and that was that Mr. Yi wanted me to confess to having motives of bringing down the North Korean regime. It was really less about the fact that we had trespassed into North Korea than the hostile intentions of trying to bring down the North Korean government. And so I was faced with this decision of making this confession. Now, in my mind, I mean, I understood that working on the story about defectors, in the eyes of the North Korean government, they see that as a threat to their government. And with my sister's involvement in the documentary and everything else that was going on, I made the decision to make that confession that I did have hostile intentions against the North Korean government. I knew that that's what they wanted to hear. And I hoped that if they felt that I was regretful about my actions, that they would offer forgiveness and let me go, which is what my interrogator had indicated could happen if I confessed.
So you did sign a multi-page confession, right, with fingerprints on every page. And then you discover after that you are to go to trial, right?
That's right. I was given a trial date, and a week before the trial date, I was assigned a defense attorney, if you can call him that. I mean, I had already written a confession, a signed confession, and here I was being offered a defense attorney who sat with me for an hour max, asking me questions really unrelated to the case at hand. And really, he was more of an extension of the prosecution I saw than a defense attorney.
And what happened at the trial?
Well, the trial was a bit similar to the investigation, asking similar questions about motives and me making a verbal confession. I had tried to prepare myself for a lengthy sentence, but really nothing could prepare me for the verdict when I heard the words 12 years. And it was after the judge said 12 years, he said, "No forgiveness, no appeal." And that really cut into me, because all along I had been hoping that there might be the opportunity for an appeal despite a long sentence. And I was wondering if those words meant that the window of opportunity had closed and my fate was sealed.
And when we say 12 years, we mean 12 years where?
12 years in a hard labor camp in North Korea. These are the notorious gulags that we hear about.
Yeah, what do you know about conditions at those camps?
Really, I mean, just the most wretched conditions. There are a couple hundred thousand, there are an estimated a couple hundred thousand political prisoners in these camps. Finding food is difficult, and people are performing backbreaking work, many of whom are tortured.
You know, I can imagine some people listening to the story that might be thinking, well, this is certainly very unfortunate, but an American journalist captured in North Korea has to know that sooner or later they're going to get to come home, that they're going to be a pawn in some diplomatic game, but they're not going to get sent to a labor camp. And today it's a year later, and you certainly sound very composed. Tell us a little, though, about your mental and emotional state at the time. What real fears you experienced and how it affected you?
Well, I did try to maintain hope throughout most of that time. And as you said, you know, I didn't know if they would in fact send us to a camp, but North Korea is also one of the most unpredictable countries in the world with a history of duplicity, and everybody you speak to is very vehement about their speaks very vehemently about their anger toward the United States. So while I try to remain hopeful, there were obviously those days when I fell into a depression and worried that they might actually send us to a camp.
You know, and Laura, I just have to think that this episode began with such a savage physical beating that that had to have affected the way you perceived it all.
It did. I was so frightened after that incident that while I said that my treatment was fair, I never knew if that could change at any moment because of what had happened.
Well, Laura Ling, so you're in Korea North Korea going on 4 months. You've been through interrogations. You've made a confession. You have been convicted at trial and sentenced to 12 years hard labor. But you have some medical problems and have been at a medical facility and have been allowed some carefully controlled phone conversations with your relatives back in the United States. And then at some point, it seems your captors began to give you an idea that there's a way out of this. How was this communicated to you?
Right. Well, I knew that they were wanting an envoy to come to our aid. It was just a matter of who.
An American envoy to come to North Korea, you mean? Yes. Yeah.
That's correct. And the way the North Koreans work is that they are very indirect. I even asked them, I said, tell me who you want, and I will try my best when I communicate with my sister. And they said, we can't tell you who. That would be a violation of your human rights. And he was very serious when he said that. And so trying to figure out who the right envoy was going to be was extremely hard. It was like deciphering a puzzle. One day I tried to bring up the name of the chairman of my company, Current TV, Vice President Al Gore, again. And I said, you know, Vice President Gore is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. He is one of the most respected post-political figures in the world. I know that he would be willing to come here. But Vice President Gore was not sufficient for them because he was the chairman of our company and he was just an extension they saw of Current TV. So at one point, one of the officials said, well, why don't we just cut off the vice and go for president? And at that moment, I said to him, sir, with all due respect, if you think that President Obama is going to get on a plane and come here, you're mistaken, and you might as well send me to a labor camp right now. And he said, well, I'm not talking about the current president. What about past presidents? And that's when President Bill Clinton's name came up.
Right. And of course, Jimmy Carter's name was in the mix at some point. I mean, you were wondering maybe he would work. And then, Lisa, of course, it was you in your occasional and carefully managed phone conversations with Laura from North Korea that this was communicated. What was it like on your end trying to figure out what they wanted?
Well, I couldn't believe that the names of some of the most well-known political figures in America were even being spewed. I mean, President Carter, President Clinton, even Vice President Gore. I couldn't definitively determine whether these were Laura's suggestions or whether these were coming from the mouths of her captors. All I could do was just trust. I mean, Laura and I are best friends. We know each other better than we even know ourselves. And so at a certain point, I had to just trust that what she was saying was what I had to try and execute. So when she brought up the two former presidents, Carter and Clinton, even though in my past experience in North Korea, I had heard that the North Koreans harbor a high regard for President Clinton, I immediately discounted him because he is married, after all, to the current Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And even though I had some concerns about Carter as a request, I just thought, you know, let's just go for it. Let's just ask and see if he would agree to go. And he did.
And then, Laura, on your end in North Korea, what was the reaction of your captors when it sounded like your conversation with your sister was going in the direction of getting Jimmy Carter to come to North Korea as an envoy?
Right. Well, I mean, I was thrilled. I had requested President Carter and Clinton and had received some indication that from a letter that I received from my family that President Carter had agreed to come. So I was overjoyed. Well, that changed when I received a visit from one of the officials who basically berated me for requesting President Carter, even though he was the person who had been in the room indicating that former President Carter was going to be a sufficient envoy. So it was hugely confusing and depressing for me after knowing that President Carter had been approved to go, that this was not the right person. It was the first time that I actually got upset in front of one of the officials. I tried to be respectful the entire time I was there. And they said, you have one more chance to convey to your family what needs to be done. And at that point, I realized that it had to be President Clinton and no one else. And the official said to me, I think that President Clinton is your best and last option. And when he said that, I knew what had to be done.
And Dave, this was, as you can imagine, this was tremendously stressful for us on the outside because we're not talking about average Joe American citizens. We're talking about former presidents of the United States. And we're talking about Vice President Gore and Governor Richardson, all of whom were being discussed or considered, or we hoped that they would be considered by the North Koreans. So to say or to get former President Carter to agree to go and then say, oh, wait a minute, I messed up. I mean, it was just incredibly, it was a lot of pressure.
But in the end, President Clinton agreed to undertake the mission, and it was arranged. And he did go to Pyongyang. And one of the fascinating details about this is the kind of jockeying for imagery that occurred between President Clinton on behalf of the Americans and the North Koreans as this meeting in Pyongyang occurred to bring Laura Ling home. And it was so fascinating, and I remember this at the time, to your description of President Clinton's expression as he landed at the airport and in his dealings with the North Korean officials. Describe that.
Well, it was a lack of expression. It was President Clinton having to maintain a look of total stoicism.
Which is so unlike him. I mean, President Clinton, we're so used to seeing this jovial character. And when he descended off that plane, just to see that completely deadpan expression on the face was so out of the ordinary.
Right. And he later said that he, in fact, had to practice that, and Hillary and Chelsea had to coach him so that he could maintain that look of total stoicism. We also learned that there was a whole itinerary that the North Koreans wanted Clinton and his team to attend. Visits to various monuments, a whole stadium filled with thousands of child acrobatic performers, and they had to be very careful to walk that line and not attend any of those events so as not to seem like they were being chummy with the North Koreans or the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. And I think they walked that line very well. They stuck to the mission that they had at hand, which was to bring us home. And
no money was exchanged, and no diplomacy was conducted. I mean, it was truly a private humanitarian mission.
Right, and the North Koreans wanted a maximum of respect from the Americans, and the Americans wanted to make it as neutral an event as possible. In the end, Clinton did end up having a very meaningful conversation with Kim Jong-il, didn't he?
Well, he mentioned to me on the plane that he had made several recommendations to Kim Jong-il, one that involved releasing some South Koreans that were being held in North Korea, a couple of South Korean fishermen as well as a businessman. And they were, in fact, released shortly after our release. And President Clinton also recommended that Kim Jong-il allow the United States Special Envoy to North Korea, Stephen Bosworth, to travel to Pyongyang and try to get back to the six-party talks, which the North Koreans also allowed several months after our return.
You know, Laura, some weeks after your return from North Korea, you were criticized in some reports from South Korea. A Reverend Lee Chan-woo, who was then living in China, said that police raided his home a few days after your capture. And he said that the authorities in China cited scenes from videos that you and your crew had taken when they interrogated him. In other words, the notion being that while you were certainly pursuing the story and acting in good faith, that you weren't careful enough and in the end may have harmed those that were trying to help refugees from North Korea. I didn't see if you or the company had responded to that since then. But what do you make of those criticisms?
I certainly live with the thought of the consequences that may have come from our actions. I will say that we were very careful in how we filmed the interview subjects and where we met them. We also know that the person who this man was working for actually spoke out about our situation very early on. I think it was maybe the day after we were captured. I think that that may have also tipped the Chinese authorities off as to the story that we were working on, because it happened so soon after our release.
This was a long and traumatic experience. Has it changed the way you approach international reporting at all? Made you any less willing to do it?
Well, currently I am very pregnant. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And expecting my first child, a baby girl, with my husband Ian. And so, of course, it's changed things a little bit in the short term. And I definitely was very, very career focused and had put off having a family for quite a while. And so right now I'm focusing on family, but I do want to continue to raise awareness about this particular issue and others that are being ignored in the world. It'll just be a matter of when and in what forum.
Well, Laura, Lisa, Ling, we're glad you're reunited. Wish you the best. And thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Laura Ling was vice president of Current TV's investigative series Vanguard when she was captured. Lisa Ling is a correspondent for The Oprah Winfrey Show and a contributor to ABC's Nightline and the National Geographic Channel. Their new book is called Somewhere Inside. Dominique Browning once held many high-power editorial positions at influential magazines, among them Newsweek, Esquire, Texas Monthly, and House and Garden. These days, she writes a monthly column for the Environmental Defense Fund's website and gardens at her house by the sea in Rhode Island. How Browning got booted out of the lofty editor seat and into a ground-level relationship with Mother Nature is the subject of her new memoir, Slow Love. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Dominique Browning was editor-in-chief of Condé Nast's House and Garden magazine for nearly 13 years. A fabulously high-powered job in a Devil Wears Prada kind of world, filled with business meetings in Paris and glitzy benefit dinners in Manhattan and deadlines and pressure. Then in 2007, House and Garden suddenly folded, and Browning was given 4 days to pack up her Hermes silk scarves and walk out into the world of the redundant. She was in her 50s, divorced, with 2 almost grown sons and a waffling cad of a lover who, after 7 years with Browning, still couldn't decide whether or not to get a divorce or even move out of the apartment he still shared with his wife. Browning's savings began to evaporate in the stock market. She couldn't sleep, and due to nervous, nocturnal nibbling, she packed on the pounds. Thanks to a hypervigilant gynecologist, Browning also discovered, in time, that she had kidney cancer. Browning has just published a memoir about losing her job and shedding her old identity. It's called Slow Love. And after reading it, all I can think is, sister, if this is what unemployment looks like, hand me that pink slip now. Especially to the nearly 10% of Americans who are currently out of work, Browning's memoir will read like a luscious fantasy of unemployment. Browning recounts how she sold her beloved home outside New York City, moved permanently into her newly renovated vacation house by the sea in Rhode Island, and threw herself into gardening, Bible reading, and mastering the Goldberg variations on her piano. The subtitle of Browning's memoir underscores its privileged class perspective. It reads, "How I Lost My Job, Put On My Pajamas, and Found Happiness." The pajamas, by the way, are from Brooks Brothers Men's Department, which Browning, a connoisseur, insists make the best pajamas for grown women. But in fairness, Browning from the get-go acknowledges that hers is not a story of financial ruin, but rather psychological collapse. Slow Love doesn't claim to be a representative tale of unemployment. Rather, it reads more like a female romance about self-resilience, much like Elizabeth Gilbert's juggernaut, Eat, Pray, Love. Taken on its own terms, Slow Love is a compelling and often funny addition to that burgeoning literary subset of autobiography, namely women's memoirs about being knocked down in midlife and painfully, arthritically, figuring out a way to get up again. The most wince-making sections of Slow Love are devoted to Browning's long love affair with the legally separated but married man she calls Stroller because he strolls away at crucial moments. Browning astutely diagnoses but remains enthralled to Stroller's weirdly intoxicating potion of loving unavailability. One of their most grotesque exchanges occurs when they're eating lunch out in New York a few days after September 11th, and Stroller announces that he's disinviting Browning to his country house and inviting his wife instead because he's worried about another terrorist attack. Browning, who feels as though she's been banished from paradise, describes her response as the derangement of a howling eve. Yet this dance of romantic ambivalence continues until the spell is weakened by Browning's cancer and the months that follow, months of unhurried, focused attention to family and friends, her own body, and nature. Browning calls this shift in focus slow love, which she says is about knowing what you've got before it's gone. What she ultimately learns has much more to do with recognizing that everything, work, love, is all too temporary. Towards the end of her nuanced memoir, she drives home this epiphany by describing the bizarre existence of the purple sea snail, which floats on the ocean on a raft of mucus. Browning writes beautifully about nature and its lessons, so I'll let her take it from here. Difficult to imagine, Browning says, such a fragile hold on life in a home anchored by no more than the thread of a baby's spittle. Perhaps we only think we have a surer grip. We float our hopes on bubbles of optimism and opportunity, and the lines that keep us alive are easily snipped.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Slow Love by Dominic Browning. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of the show at freshair.npr.org.